Well, we want to talk about covenants tonight as a foundation for the premillennial belief system. If you'll recall, as we've looked at through the various approaches to the millennial question or issues, that there are basically four approaches. Two of them are premillennial, but there's the other three share something in common, even one of the premillennial views. So you have amillennialism, which is basically saying that there is no earthly kingdom. It's not saying there's not a kingdom. It's just not an earthly reign of Jesus in that sense of a kingdom. Postmillennialism, though it has a different view of kingdom, it's saying that Jesus returns after an established millennium. So obviously he's not reigning on earth in the kingdom, because the kingdom occurs before he returns. Right. You know, so you have the kingdom, and then Jesus returns at the consummation of that kingdom. Premillennialism says that Christ returns and then establishes his kingdom. And so in premillennial, you're looking at an earthly, literal kingdom in which Jesus is on earth reigning in that kingdom. But within premillennial thought or view, there are two approaches. There's what is sometimes referred to as historic premillennialism, or a classic premillennialism, or sometimes covenant premillennialism. And its approach is saying, in essence, and we're not sure what to do with the Old Testament. So the Old Testament is not a foundation for our premillennial views. But we look at the New Testament, and we see in Revelation 20 that it speaks of a literal 1,000 years. And we take that passage literally, therefore we are premillennial. Then the other approach is dispensational premillennial, which is the one that most of us are, you know, more familiar with. And in dispensational premillennialism, it finds its foundation in the Old Testament. It would agree that the New Testament teaches it. So if there wasn't an Old Testament, there still would be a premillennial view, because the New Testament teaches it. But the foundation doesn't come from the New Testament. The foundation comes from the Old Testament and the promises that God made to Israel, and that God will keep those promises. So thus, we see a major difference between, or some of the difference between the historic premillennialist and the dispensationalist, is that this view of Israel, promises to Israel, that the foundation for dispensationalism is that God made these promises to Israel. They haven't been fulfilled. Since he is a trustworthy, truthful God, they must be fulfilled. And so there's always this distinction between the church and Israel. Within the other systems, regardless if it's pre-mill or all-mill or post-mill, that distinction between Israel becomes blurred. And so for the classic pre-mill, there's no distinction between Israel and the church until in that tribulation period in millennial kingdom. And then there's some distinction, though it's not as fine of a distinction as in dispensationalism. So we want to consider the dispensational view, and we want to look at the foundation that finds its earliest foundation in the promises God made to Israel, and specifically in the biblical covenants. Dispensationalism, the dispensationalist makes more out of biblical covenants than do covenant theology. If you were to hear about the term covenant theology, you might think that covenant theology is going to make a major thing out of all the covenants. But that's not true. The focus becomes on really two specific covenants that really aren't necessarily major biblical covenants. But some of the covenants in Scripture would be the Adamic covenant, Adamic covenant, and the Noahic covenant, and then also the Mosaic covenant. All of those are covenants, especially the Mosaic covenant is a primary one that we hear about. Also the one with Noah. Everybody's aware of that. There are certain little cartoons in the funny papers have always been very good about interjecting theology or faith issues at certain times. And that the comic strip Peanuts was one that, while it was about nothing most of the time, every once in a while it would insert some his belief system and so forth. And one of them, they're talking about theology. I forgot exactly how it's worded, but and I forgot which one is talking, who it is that's doing the talking, but it's looking up. Charlie Brown, let's say, is, and he's talking about the rainbow, and you know, God's promise, and the good. He's saying good theology or sound doctrine, you know, gives you confidence. You know, look at the rainbow and the promise there. So we know about that covenant. But the ones that we really want to focus on are the ones that that are built off the Abrahamic covenant. The Abrahamic covenant is a foundational covenant, and there are three additional covenants that each one picks up one of the main focuses within the Abrahamic covenant and addresses that. So the land covenant, the Davidic covenant, and the new covenant. So first, the Abrahamic covenant. Charles Ryrie states that there's really two crucial questions related to the Abrahamic covenant. And it's that, does the Abrahamic covenant promise Israel a permanent existence as a nation? That's really becomes the question. Is there a promise that it will be a nation? Secondly, is there a promise that it will have land, that it will have this possession of this promised land? So those are become two issues. And if those promises, if we see that, okay, that's what God promised Israel, then won't they be fulfilled? Now, others that reject it, they just come along somewhere and say, well, Israel rejected God, the church came in place, and the church just takes over, and so those become spiritualized promises to the church. And it's just kind of a dismissal sense. Foundational issues, if you look at some verses, if we can find these in the verses, such as, and we're not going to look at all, there are just lots of passages that we could look at on this, but we just want to look at two. Where it's first introduced, it would be Genesis 12, and then when the covenant is actually made in Genesis 15. In Genesis 12, 1-3, it says, "Now the Lord said to Abram, go forth from your country, and from your relatives, and from your father's house, to the land which I will show you, and I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you, and make your name great, so that you shall be a blessing, and I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth will be blessed." Well, there are several things we can note about that. First is that he's told to go to a land that God will actually show him. So it truly is a call of faith. It's not even, go to some place, but pack up, head out, I'll show you. As we're going, I'll show you. So it's a real issue of faith. But he says, "I will make you a great nation. I will bless you. I will make your name great. You will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you. I will curse those who curse you. And all the families of the earth will be blessed through you." So we see, what is it? It's unconditional. He says, "I will bless you." There's no condition. It's unconditional. That's not if you do this, if you do that. It's national in the sense that I will make you a great nation. It's geographical in that there's a land. It's international. It's beyond. It's universal, you could say, in that it's all the families of the earth will be blessed, and I will bless those who bless you. So it has that far-reaching aspect. In chapter 15, we come to a place where the actual covenant is set up. It says, "Then behold, the word of the Lord came to him, Abraham, saying, this man will not be your heir, but one who will come forth from your own body. He shall be your heir. And he took him outside and said, now look toward the heavens and count the stars, if you are able to count them. And he said to him, so shall your descendants be. Then he believed in the Lord, and he reckoned it to him as righteousness. And he said to him, I am the Lord who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldeans. to give you this land to possess it. He said, O Lord God, how may I know that I will possess it? So he said to him, bring me a three-year-old heifer and a three-year-old female goat and a three-year-old ram and a turtle dove and a young pigeon. Then he brought all these to him and he cut them in two and laid each half opposite the other. But he did not cut the birds. The birds of prey came down upon the carcasses, and Abram drove them away. Now when the sun was going down upon the carcasses, and Abram drove them away, missed a line there. Now when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram, and behold, terror and great darkness fell upon him. And God said to Abraham, know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, where they will be enslaved and oppressed 400 years. But I will also judge the nation whom they will serve, and afterwards they will come out with many possessions. As for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace, and you will be buried at a good old age. Then in the fourth generation they will return here, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete. It came about when the sun had set that it was very dark, and behold, there appeared a smoking oven and a flaming torch which passed between these pieces. On that day the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, to your descendants I will give this land, from the river of Egypt as far as to the great river, the river Euphrates. Well, it's unconditional. If you notice, when the actual covenant is inaugurated, that Abram is asleep. This seems like a very strange way to make a covenant, an arrangement, is to take animals and cut them in two and lay them on two sides of a walkway. But this was a specific kind of covenant of that time period, a Susanine a treaty covenant. And what you have in this situation is you have not two people that are equal, but you have an equality here. And so God allows or causes Abraham to go to sleep, would seem to be the case, and God himself is the one that walks through it, establishing the covenant. The covenant is not dependent upon Abraham. The covenant is solely dependent upon God. God establishes the covenant. And so it's not between two equals, but it's between a vassal of one that's of a higher rank and one of a lesser rank. So it's unconditional. There's no requirements made on the part of Abraham, but the requirement is for God to carry it out. It's geographical. It spoke specifically of the land again. And it and just of note in this passage is a connection on the whole idea of justification, that Abraham, God told him to count the stars, and he looks at the stars, and in this sense of believing what God is saying, that your descendants will be as the stars, he believes God, and it's that issue of faith becomes a picture in the New Testament for justification. And so as we look at this overall, this covenant has an unconditional character. It has this eternal quality. It's referred to as an everlasting, lasting covenant several times. There are several passages there in Genesis 17, three times, in 1 Chronicles. So it's referred to repeatedly as an everlasting covenant. So there may be delays, such as even now God is telling Abram that your descendants, are going to be in captivity for 400 years. But it's still going to be fulfilled. So there may be times that there are delays, there may be postponement, but it will be fulfilled because God refers to it as an everlasting covenant. It has an unconditional quality. Obedience is not listed as a condition. And as we mentioned, in that establishing the covenant, it was only God that walked through it. God established it. Norman Geisler says, the first of Israel's covenant is an unconditional agree God made with Abram and his descendants that has never been fulfilled at any time in history, either prior to or after the advent. because Israel rejected their Messiah king who is to rule in Jerusalem over the whole land God gave Abraham, and since this reign is to be forever, the event is yet future. It will not be fulfilled until Christ returns. At that time, at this time, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, David, and all other New Testament saints will be raised and literally will reign over the whole earth in physical resurrected bodies. So it's looking still forward to this this covenant. And that covenant, as it touches on all of these idea of descendants and land and blessings, becomes the foundation for, or not the foundation, becomes the umbrella, it would, covenant that the other three covenants specifically take up one point and deal with. One, yes. Well, obviously, I mean, there obviously are issues in the sense that he's told to do something and he does it, but it's not laid out as a condition in the sense of that if you do this, you'll be blessed this way, and if you don't do it, you're not going to be blessed. And you know, if you and your descendants keep all of these things, then I'm going to make you a great people. But if you don't keep them, then it's not set up in that sense. There are obvious aspects that, though they're not really conditional, when God says, you're to go here, Abraham is obedient and goes there. But it's not set up in the sense of condition, especially in chapter 15, also in that also. But within the language, when you read the stories, you'll always find some of those things we could, have those to ask questions about, because God has always given directives. And you say, well, if it's a directive, then it's conditional. But that's not in the nature of the covenant.
And are there any of those that, parts of that really haven't been fulfilled in one way or another?
Well, none of them have ever been fulfilled. The land is, because there's a... an everlasting aspect to it, and as it goes on, about the descendants, and as we look at the other ones about the kingdom being established in the Davidic kingdom. But the land has never been fully occupied.
There has to be a point where their name is great and will remain great forever.
Yeah, I mean, there's this... and I think as we see those maybe dealt with in the other passages that... In the Davidic covenant, as it establishes a throne, a kingdom, a king and a kingdom, but then also the land. So there's the land. There's never been the fullness of the land, and part of that is when we look in like in Judges, in Joshua, I should say, when they go into the land, they never fully take the land as they were told to because of their own disobedience at that time. They become content to stop warring and just take what's there. They become content to let other people live in the land, even though that's not what they were directed to do. So there is some, even though the occupation of the land was huge, it's never as full as the boundaries gave. Yeah. Well, I guess, twofold. One is that God said it would be, and so that becomes the hard issue. And then the other one is that it's something that is repeated. It's not like it's just made this one time. This is something that's repeated several times. Several times in Genesis, and then but other... passages also, and it has this aspect of just looking at this everlasting covenant. So even if they were to have possessed it at one time, that's truly not everlasting possession, even if you had it, it didn't continue. And there's this sense of it having a different quality to it. We kind of see that in the land covenant. And you probably know the land covenant more as the Palestinian covenant. You may have heard that terminology more. Excuse me. However, the Palestinian covenant, while it communicated well at one point, is no longer a good communicative word for this, because one is it has a political tone to it now, and then the other one, it has an anti-Israel tone to it. So at one time, Palestine was a term that just kind of described the area where Israel was, and that's why it was used. But that isn't, it was never a biblical term, and so most now don't use that terminology because of some of the other aspects of it, and just call it a land covenant. This is the one that doesn't have just a great name in that regard. But the passage, key passage, would be in Deuteronomy chapter 30. And remember in Deuteronomy that Deuteronomy is written right before they go into the land. So in the lifespan of Moses, or I should say in the not his lifespan, but as Israel is moving from Egypt to the promised land, the book of Exodus would describe that coming out and much of the wandering period there, but it is it includes the giving of the law. Well, Deuteronomy means is a second giving of the law. That is, Moses is restating things to a new generation that will go into the promised land. So this is after the 40 years in the wilderness that Moses is writing this. And Moses will not be going in with them, and he's writing this to restate the law. And in chapter 30, verse 1 to 10, it says, "So it shall be when all these things have come upon you, the blessing and the curse which I have set before you, and you call them to mind in the nations where the Lord your God has banished you, and you return to the Lord your God and obey him with all your heart and soul according to all that I command you today, you and your sons, then the Lord your God will restore you from captivity and have compassion on you and gather you again from all the peoples where the Lord your God has scattered you. If your outcasts are in the ends of the earth, from there the Lord your God will gather you from there, and he will bring you back. And the Lord your God will bring you into the land which your fathers possessed, and you shall possess it. And he will prosper you and multiply you more than your fathers. Moreover, the Lord your God will circumcise your heart and the heart of your descendants to love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul in order that you may live. And the Lord your God will inflict all these curses on your enemies and those who hate you and persecute you. And you shall again obey the Lord and observe all his commandments, which I commanded you today. Then the Lord your God will prosper you and abundantly in all the work of your hand, in the offspring of your body, and in the offspring of your cattle, and in the produce of your ground. For the Lord will again rejoice over you for good, just as he rejoiced over your fathers. If you obey the Lord your God to keep his commandments and his statutes which are written in this book of the law, if you turn to the Lord your God with all your heart." In this, there is, looking once again at this aspect of a restoration of Israel. A time when they will return from captivity, a time when they will be restored to the land, a time when they will have this prosperity in the land and have that possession of the land. So it's this restatement, if you will, of of the promises earlier about the land, and just restating that they will one time respond and be in the land and come back to the land. But notice, you know, this is looking yet future, because at this point they haven't even possessed the land. They haven't even been into it. This isn't written to a people that have already been there for some time, but it's written that they were going to go in and take the land, but yet it's looking at a period even further beyond that when they come back. And so it's, you know, here we see a restatement of that. And then the Davidic promise comes into this, or covenant comes into this aspect of the descendants, and not only speaks of the descendants, but specifically narrows that descendants as it comes to Abraham and goes through the patriarchs and gets down to the person of David and follows that line of David, you know, as far as the king. So the Davidic covenant, which we find in 2 Samuel, you know, takes on that aspect of the seed promises and narrows it all the way down to David. So in 2 Samuel chapter 7, he has a plan for Israel. That's one of the reasons.
Yeah, and that's
yeah.
Why they don't combine us.
Yeah. That's really the primary, that'd be one of the reasons, is, and a primary reason is saying God has a plan for Israel. And it didn't stop at the cross. It, you know, didn't get converted over to the church. It, you know, the church and you know, comes in not to replace Israel, but if that, you know, if you would, it's kind of a parenthesis, so to speak. God is, you know, his primary work focus right now is in the church, but Israel still has that place. In 2 Samuel chapter 7, verses 12, 17, says, when your days are complete and you lie down with your fathers, I will raise up your descendants after you, who will come forth from you, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for a name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be a father to him, and he will be a son to me. When he commits iniquity, I will correct him with the rod of men and the strokes of the sons of men. But my loving kindness shall not depart from him, as I took it away from Saul, whom I removed from before you. And your house and your kingdom shall endure before me forever. Your throne shall be established forever. In accordance with all these words and all this vision, so Nathan spoke to David. So here, you know, once again, we see some promises. David was promised a future generation. That is, you know, his prosperity. He talks about a son, descendants, talks about his house, you know, your house being a reference to his physical descendants. He was promised a throne that would be established forever. He was promised a kingdom that would be established forever. That, so therefore, that'd be an earthly political kingdom over Israel. And so this one comes in and you know, is viewed as being a part of that Abrahamic covenant when it talks about descendants and narrows those descendants, continues those descendants, but becomes a focus on the king. Not just descendants, but a specific descendant becomes a king in the kingdom. And you can't have a kingdom without people, so even speaking of a kingdom, you're speaking of other people, but also specifically a king. And then the third one, as it talked about blessings in the Abrahamic covenant, then would be the new covenant. The new covenant, you know, has a focus on spiritual blessings and material blessings, the spiritual blessings of redemption for Israel, and it therefore develops, or, you know, is an outflow of that blessings part of the Abrahamic covenant. The key passage would be in Jeremiah 31. Jeremiah 31, verse 31. Behold, days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. Not like the covenant which I made with their fathers in the land in the day I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt. So, not like the Mosaic covenant. This is a different covenant. My covenant which they broke, although I was a husband to them, declares the Lord. But this is the covenant which I will make with the house of Israel after those days, declares the Lord. I will put my law within them, and on their heart I will write it, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. And they shall not teach again each man his neighbor and each man his brother, saying, Know the Lord. For they shall all know me, from the least of them to the greatest of them, declares the Lord. For I will forgive their iniquity and their sin, and I will remember no more. This is also repeated in Ezekiel. Has some little different aspects in Ezekiel. And then it's, you know, but as you look at this, it's a promise for redemption. It's a promise of a spiritual aspect. It talks about a new heart, a new spirit. And so the spirit in that aspect would be like a new life, a new heart in the sense of a new disposition. Then also he says he'll put his spirit upon them. So you have this totally, this dynamic spiritual blessing taking place. Redemption is promised. So when you think through that then, so you have a promise of a land, a promise of descendants, but there's a need for those descendants to have a spiritual relationship with the Lord. So there's this promise of a spiritual blessing, redemption for this. Now, the interesting thing with this covenant, however, is that it is mentioned in the New Testament. And it's mentioned in context that involves us. So what's the nature of that covenant? Well, surely the final and complete fulfillment of the New Covenant is still future, as it will find its total fulfillment in the nation of Israel during the Millennial Kingdom. It primarily is a spiritual blessing, but there are some material aspects to it. But so the question then is, what is that relationship with the church since it is addressed in the New Testament? Well, dispensational views have moved over time, and from looking at from the earliest to the present, it was said that the New Covenant only applied to Israel. And so the early dispensationalists kept that distinction very firm, saying that the covenant is like the other covenants. It only applies to Israel. It's only a covenant for Israel. And then later on, it kind of came out and said, well, there's the New Testament talks about this new covenant. There's actually two covenants. There's two different new covenants. There's this new covenant that was Israel, and there's a new covenant that's with the church. But that one really breaks down because it's hard to define and support the idea that there's two covenants. And so presently, the church participates. The church benefits from the new covenant or some aspects of the new covenant right now. It's not that the covenant was made with us. The covenant was made with Israel. The covenant will be fulfilled in Israel. But as Christ inaugurated the new covenant, we benefit from it. So those spiritual blessings that are there by the very fact of the death of Christ as he inaugurates that new covenant, as he lays the foundation for it, it pours over on us. And so we benefit from the new covenant, but the full, complete fulfillment of it is yet future in Israel. And so there are certain aspects of it that are a little stronger than we would even see in our own lives, but yet we do see certain aspects. For instance, the idea that this new spirit, in the sense that we have a new regenerated life, we find that taught in the New Testament, and we see that there. We have this new new heart, not an old heart, a new heart, not a hard heart, but a pliable heart. We have this new nature, a new disposition, and then the Holy Spirit indwells us, as opposed to the various aspects of feeling in the Old Testament. But in the New Testament, there's that indwelling. So the church participates in it, but it hasn't taken its place. It yet will be in in the future. There's a chart on the very last that just takes these covenants, and it takes the Abrahamic covenant and shows that from the Abrahamic covenant flows a land covenant, and it continues and will find fulfillment in the kingdom. It goes through the Davidic covenant. We'll find that fulfillment there. There's a new covenant that goes through, but yet with the cross finds fulfillment, both a partial fulfillment in the church, or a blessing outgrowth of it, not fulfillment, but a sense of shedding this blessing, and then finds its fulfillment in the kingdom. The Mosaic covenant didn't originate, isn't an outgrowth of the Abrahamic covenant, and the Mosaic covenant went to the cross. If you notice, it stops there. It's not something that continues. We're not under the Mosaic covenant in that regard. So that's just kind of a visual overview of those covenants. But with these covenants, then becomes, a foundation for a dispensational premillennial view, is that God has made promises to Israel, promises that have to do with a land, a people, and a spiritual blessing, a spiritual people. So physical people and a spiritual aspect of those people. And that promise, or those promises, will be yet fulfilled. Thus, God has to have a plan for Israel. And so as we see a kingdom coming, then that kingdom is about the fulfillment of that kingdom that God has already talked about. And so as opposed to the classic dispensationalists that say, premillennialists that say, well, we see a kingdom in the New Testament, we don't know it through the Old Testament. Dispensationalist says, well, you just take these promises literally. God said it's going to happen, and that's when it's going to happen. And so the foundation is in these Old Testament passages. And so that's... any thoughts or comments? I don't know at this point if I want to say specifically. I'm not sure on those passages. But in general, let's just say that there will be, we'll look at those passages. But just in the broad scope, that when Christ returns, then he will establish his kingdom. And that kingdom will be a fulfillment in part and foundationally of these promises. That's when these promises will find their ultimate fulfillment, is in his kingdom on earth. And he will be the king fulfilling that Davidic aspects of the descendant of, the descendants of Abraham in that regard. There will be in the land, and then there will be this spiritual new covenant aspects of people coming to the Lord.
Is it possible there's two views? Either he comes and the new city comes and like that, and that 1,000-year reigns, or he comes and reigns 1,000 years and the temple that is described in Ezekiel is building. That part takes place 1,000 years and then the city is.
Yeah, that's why I'm not real sure on that. Well, you end up with the new heavens and new earth and an eternal state, and so some of that description,
Well, because of that promise, if the moon's gone, light's gone, his covenant's erased, well, if you have a whole new heaven and earth and the sun and all of that's going to be erased, would you say, okay, that's the point, it ends, and now the new one begins?
Yeah, in some sense, though, there is a sense that it continues forever, in the sense that Christ, the incarnation, from our perspective, in this idea of time with God, it's really difficult. But from our perspective, the second person of the Trinity went along, and then at one point in history, the incarnation took place. And, you know, and so the man and the divine were joined together, and that continues forever. And so Christ will reign. You know, I mean, you know, it's not like at some point then that's separated, and which through, you know, there's a sense that aspect of kingdom would continue, but not necessarily in this aspect, because it wouldn't be
it. It almost makes it an earthly aspect.
Right.
And so when you're trying to describe heaven,
Yeah. Well, if you spiritualize, then the stuff with kingdom all just becomes heaven. You know, and so it's. Yeah. And so what we would be saying is that there really is a literal earthly kingdom. Now, there still is, if we want to call it heaven, there is a heaven, and that's yet future too. But those two shouldn't be confused. There is a literal coming of Jesus to the earth, as opposed to, there's no literal coming of Jesus to establish kingdom, but there's a coming of Jesus. He comes for you at your death. At my father's funeral, that was part of the message, that statement. You know, I mean, you know, so the idea of the coming of Christ was viewed that Christ, you know, came for my dad. So that's the second coming of Christ, was at his death. So that's where you dismiss all everything related to fulfillment of eschatology. You don't see a literal return of Christ. So that's a very liberal. That's not even, that becomes very liberal theology even in that regard. But the others that aren't necessarily liberal would, you know, like all millennials, well, there is no earthly kingdom. And so that idea of kingdom and heaven would just merge together. There's that spiritual kingdom. Christ is in his kingdom now. And, you know, so it's just the same as heaven. But we're saying there will be an earthly kingdom. Christ will reign on earth. And so, and that's where we'll go in our studies after that. Right.
They were looking for a kingdom that was going to set up and be king.
Yeah, right.
Right.
Yeah, and nobody's disagreeing about that. The disagreement just becomes, well, since that didn't occur, then those, it just all kind of, Israel got pushed aside and the church just took its place.
Except for Israel still looking for something that will happen.
Right. But they're just, but from those people's standpoint, they're just misinformed. But from from our standpoint, they're misinformed too, because it's not a believing Israel looking for anything, because there is no believing Israel.
There isn't?
No.
Nobody in Israel, the nation now, believes.
It's not a believing Israel. There may be individuals believing, but if they're individuals believing, they are Christians, because we're in the church. So there is no believing Israel. Cannot be a believing Israel at this point.
There'll be something different still to be believed.
Not saying people in Israel aren't believing. There aren't any Jewish believers, but if you're a Jewish believer, you're in the church and not in the nation of Israel, because we're not in that period. We're in the dispensation of the church.
You could say the word saved.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You could have an Israel that believes, but they're not saved.
No, you don't have a believing Israel. Israel cannot have a relationship with God. If they have a relationship with God, they're Christians. Jewish people that have an aspect of a future Messiah coming have rejected Jesus as Messiah. In no way that you could truly call them believing. They may be believing in the sense that they're looking forward to certain promises, but remember, they're also ones that reject it. So the very people that rejected Jesus on the cross would be believing Israel in that same regard. So, you know, so when we look at Israel, and this becomes the kind of goofy things, when we look at Israel having regathered in the land, that is not the biblical nation of Israel in the sense of a believing Israel, because it's not there. But is that a precursor, or is that a movement toward these fulfillments of these other things? Would appear so. But not necessarily the same.
All the believers are raptured. Something has to still be, okay, you're saying after 7 years they become a believing nation again.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's a point where Israel will respond to God. Yeah. But the tribulation is going back to that 70th week of Daniel, as we'll see, and is, you know, focused upon Israel. And then they move in into the millennial kingdom, you know, as the people of God in that in that period. And we're not there. We're gone. Any prayer requests?